You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Yes, you are tuned into The Wire. Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Lillian Hanley tōku ingoa nō mai. Haere mai ki Te Wire mo tēnei rā, tērā te kaumawha o Hui Tāngaru. Hello and welcome to The Wire for Wednesday the 14th of February. Apologies. Today was... My name is Lillian Hanley. Hello, everyone. I'm joined in studio by Will Parsonson, my producer, and Alan Blackman, our esteemed Dear Science guest. How are you guys?
Good. Yeah, I'm fine, as per usual.
Okay. I'm pumped.
Good.
I'm excited.
Ooh. Now, I'm just going to put it out there. Will told me to tell everyone, you know, Happy Valentine's Day, and I shut him down and said I didn't want to engage with a capitalist consumerist sort of event, but I was willing to call Alan's segment Allentine. Alan, oh, we're going to say something like that.
My goodness.
Well, Allentine's.
Allentine's.
That works. I like that. Yeah.
Also, just want to put out there that Cook, you know, Captain Cook, that guy,
yep.
he died today.
He did indeed die today.
He got beaten today.
He got messed up today.
Yes, so. I noticed that, yeah.
So that's probably something we could, you know, this could be that day, not Valentine's Day. Anyway, on the show... on Dear Science with AUD's Alan Blackman, we are talking about asparagus, the moles, and an international year of the periodic table.
Absolutely.
Producer Ruben McLaren finds out if the recent share market panic is a cause for concern. Producer Will Parsonson talks about the potential importance of this. No.
No, I did that last week. It's one thing I said don't read, but
all
you
right.
read it. Forget
didn't
that,
hear
listeners.
That, sorry. We reuse our run sheets and update them as we go, but we'll didn't do anything. Tracy Martin from New Zealand First talks a bit about her Waitangi Day. That's not true either. I haven't updated this. God, what a mess. It's been a bit, we've got a lot of content today anyway. Anything can happen. What Tracy Martin does talk about is the Child Poverty Reduction Bill, the Housing Stock Take Report, Māori sovereignty, and how important a leader is to a political party following Bill English's announcements yesterday. Also, we had Wire Worry Week last week, and it was about Waitangi, but I kept investigating. I couldn't stop, and so we're talking a bit more about it later in the show today, but particularly about the universities' commitment to a treaty partnership. Anyway, up first.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, it is interesting. Alan, how are you?
I am very well, Lillian. As I said, I'm pumped. I'm excited.
Pumped. Is that? I mean, okay. Should we start with the international? Can we do that first?
We can, but I was going to start with something even before that.
But you were pumped. If you're pumped about this first story,
No, I'm not pumped about the story. I'm pumped about the fact we're, you know, Ben Folds is playing in Auckland next Monday at the power station. There you go. So that's what I'm pumped about.
That's science, Alan.
So if your tastes run to Elton John and Billy Joel, and I know they're absolute anathema to a student radio station, if you like your piano ballads, then go and see Ben Folds because he's bloody good.
Okay.
There you go.
There we go. All right, we're pumped about that.
Right.
What are we not pumped about, first story?
What are we not pumped about? Well, asparagus. Mm. Okay, so a recent, like last week, paper in Nature, which is the bastion of good science, says that if you have breast cancer, if you're unfortunate enough to have breast cancer, then the thing to do is to cut out foods that contain an amino acid called asparagine from your diet. And one of the foods that contains high levels of asparagine is asparagus. So what happened was that these guys did a study with mice, as they often do in these cases, and they found that the mice who had breast cancer, the bad thing about breast cancer obviously is once it metastasizes and goes into other parts of the body, then it becomes sort of untreatable. So you want to try and keep it localized. And what they found was that asparagine, this amino acid, seems to allow the tumours to metastasize.
And faster or just
Well, just metastasize and go elsewhere in the body, so which is definitely not what you want. So what they did was two things. They reduced the amount of asparagine in the diet of these mice, And they also treated the mice with a drug called asparaginase, which decomposes asparagine and turns it into sort of harmless stuff. And in both cases, they found that the spread of the tumours were or was pretty much halted, certainly reduced enormously anyway. So by keeping that out of their diet, it made a real difference. Now, what it didn't do was to cure the original cancer in the first place, okay? So this isn't a cure, but it's something that will stop the metastasizing of the tumour cells and spreading and, you know, leading to bad outcomes, which it often does.
So the asparagus only worsens the cancer. It doesn't give you breast cancer.
No. That's the thing. And again, I've sort of looked at this on a few news sites, and they're saying that, yes, asparagus gives you cancer. No, it doesn't.
That's not it.
No,
okay.
It's not it. Once you've got it, it slows its progress, basically, or halts its progress, and it keeps it localized. So therefore, sort of radical surgery like mastectomies and stuff like that have a better chance of succeeding if it hasn't gotten to your lymph nodes and, you know, all of those sort of places where it tends to go into the bloodstream, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, this is kind of interesting stuff. This was done by the Cancer Research UK division in Cambridge. So, you know, you can pretty much hang your hat on that, presumably. And, yeah, very, very interesting stuff. Now, again, obviously, this is only on mice models. So they've only done this on mice. They haven't done this on human trials or anything like that. But it's obviously something that now is in the pipeline. They'll be looking at human trials for this, I would imagine, looking for volunteers, probably with sort of advanced breast cancer or whatever, and see whether this actually works. So, you know, it's nice. This fight against this nasty bloody disease, cancer, you know, it's just ongoing and ongoing and ongoing. And every week you hear of, you know, cures or possible cures or whatever. There's an awful, awful lot of people
working
investing
on it.
An awful, awful, awful lot of time, you know, in trying to just stop this. And one day we will. I'm damn sure we will. But, you know, it may be a while off. We need to understand really the molecular basis of cancer. And once we can do that, and once we can target cancer cells absolutely specifically, then we'll be onto something.
Do they inject the mice with the cancer?
Yeah, basically they give them cancer in the first place. Yeah, I know.
Wow.
I know.
Okay.
Yeah, mice are cute. I know. It's tough. Mm. There's there's really no other alternative at this stage. Maybe in years to come we can do all sort of computer modelling and stuff like that, but, you know. So that would occupy a whole hour, I think, sort of a discussion of the pros and cons of animal studies, et cetera, et cetera.
Perhaps another week.
Yeah.
What's the, if this is this only breast cancer or is it any kind of cancer?
They've only looked at breast cancer at the moment, okay?
So it's not necessarily going to affect men, is that correct?
No, men can get breast cancer. Yeah. I've got a mate.
I did not know that.
Oh, yes. Yeah. No, a friend of mine got breast cancer. It was, you know, and it's a hell of a thing to go and tell people that you've got breast cancer when you're a guy.
It's super uncommon either.
Yeah,
so there's a misconception that it's... Mm. Yeah.
That's interesting. You think that there'd be more awareness around that because there's a number of sort of breast cancer awareness ads targeted at women.
Yes, which by, you know, and obviously that's the majority of people who get it. But, you know, you're right. You can get it if you're a guy and it's not that uncommon.
Yeah. Right. New definitions of moles.
Oh, yes, indeed. Here we go.
I don't know what the original definition
Shame
of
on
a mole.
You, Lillian. Goodness me. Will, definition of the mole?
Just gonna nod.
Okay, I apologize for this one in advance because it is a little bit geeky, but it's very important to the chemists in the world. So, where do we start? Right, we've got units. We've got units. So, for example, we've got the unit of time, which is the second. Okay, we've got the unit of length, which is the meter. And we've got the unit of mass, which is the kilogram. The unit of electric current, which is the ampere.
I'm following.
The unit of luminous intensity, brightness, which is the candela. There's one more that I've missed. The unit of temperature, which is the Kelvin. And there's one more, and that's the unit of a thing called amount of substance. And that unit is the mole. Now, anybody who has studied sixth form, as it used to be in my day, but now it's year 12. God. Chemistry would know what a mole is, or should know what a mole is. Okay.
I didn't.
You didn't
study. at sixth form. No. I did at fifth form.
Okay, so the analogy that we use when we're teaching this sort of stuff is we're talking about really, really small things. Atoms, molecules, things like that. Tiny, unimaginably small. Okay? Mm. We know the mass of them really quite accurately. They're around about 10 to the minus 24 of a kilogram. You know, just ridiculously small, beyond our comprehension small. But what we do in the lab is that we don't work on those tiny scales. We work in gram scales. When you're doing a chemical reaction, we're going to weigh out 6 grams of that, 4 grams of that, blah de blah de blah. And in that mass, we've got to know the number of atoms or molecules, because we know that they're going to, when they react, they're going to react in a 1-to-1 or a 2-to-1 or a 3-to-1 ratio or whatever, okay? So we need to know the number of atoms or molecules in a 1 gram sample, something like that. And the way that we do that is we use a thing called the mole. And the basis of the mole at the moment is the number of atoms that are in exactly 12 grams of the carbon isotope 12C.
Definitely got that.
Yeah, well, you and many other first year chemistry students, okay? But that is a particular number, okay? And the number is humongously big, 6.022 times 10 to the 23. That's what one mole is. 6 by 10 to the 23 anythings constitutes a mole of that anything, okay?
Right.
So one mole, okay. One mole of carbon weighs 12 grams and it contains 6.022 times 10 to the 23 carbon atoms. Okay.
So carbon is sort of the base of this measurement.
Yeah, good.
Just like how you'd say a kg is 1 liter of water.
Exactly the same sort of thing. Okay.
Science.
Good. So this is the basis of the mole. So as I say, one mole of carbon weighs 12 grams. One mole of carbon dioxide weighs 44.01 grams. One mole of oxygen weighs 32 grams, etc. But they all contain the same number of atoms/molecules. So that's the definition that's used currently, and now they're going to have a new definition.
We just got it!
No.
We just got it.
I know you just got it, but now it's easier because they're just saying, right, one mole is 6.022140 76 times 10 to the 23 anything.
Oh, it's way easier.
So you don't have to worry about the 12 grams of carbon and stuff anymore. This is going to make life way easier for your average student and stuff like that.
We just need to know that the number is the same all the time.
Yeah, so there you go.
And they're not changing the number.
No, they've changed the number just a wee smidge.
They have changed.
Yeah, they have. And this is, and it's not going to make a blind bit of difference to anybody's life, but, you know, I'm going to have to rewrite the section in my textbook, you know, about what a mole is and everything like that.
You're secretly excited, though, aren't you?
This is chemistry in action, folks. You know, this is good stuff. So.
Dear Science has turned into, like, a lecture series. We're actually really learning stuff here.
I do go away from my show, you know, like the show, I go away and I teach people. I'm like, hey, I learned this today.
Good.
I mean, it is helpful though, right? You are correcting and you're challenging yourself. Science is growing. It's being like, actually this, I mean, not that it was wrong. No, it was just saying this is an easier way of.
Well, so at the moment, all of these units, except for the kilogram and the mole, are defined not in terms of physical objects. Okay. So the kilogram is defined in terms of a physical object. There's a piece of platinum alloy in France, which is a perfect sphere, and it weighs exactly 1 kilogram. And so every weight on the planet is referenced back to this platinum sphere in a bank vault in France, which weighs 1 kilogram. Now, the trouble with that is that over the past century or so, since it's been there, its mass has changed a little bit because there's stuff in the air and everything, and so now it's sort of gained a tiny, tiny little bit of mass.
Wow.
Now, so you don't want to have your basis of mass as being a physical object whose mass can change. Mm. So now they're going to redefine the kilogram as well in terms of other reference points, yes, which aren't then based on physical objects. So
this is why I love the metric system, because they're all so pedantic about it, and then in the US they're using imperial.
The metric system rocks, it really does. And the sooner that those three countries, which are, who don't use it,
I want to say Great Britain, but I feel like they do use metric.
No, they're kind of half and half. They can't make up their minds. They still do their motorways and stuff and miles and everything, but they do their masses and kilograms and stuff like that.
Right.
So it's the USA, obviously, is the biggie, and Liberia and Burma/Myanmar don't use the metric system. So there's only three countries in the world that don't. And they all really should, because it is very simple.
But then again, you could probably argue that NASA and all them are using metric because it's...
NASA. Yeah, now that's the nice example of the whole metric thing, because they had a Mars Climate Orbiter spacecraft way back when, in the 90s, and it crashed into Mars because one of the team was using imperial measurements and the other team was using metric measurements for the thrust to work out their thrust.
Seems a little bit unprofessional.
So when it's coming down to land on the surface, they buggered up their thrust units, and so it just went... Bang.
Oh my god.
And that was a few million down the tubes. That was all because of units.
We need more sound effects like that. Oh, brilliant.
Wow.
So there you go. Units are useful.
Very important. Okay, last one. Yep. International Year of the Periodic Table.
Well, there's really not much to say about this. Next year has been deemed by the UN the International Year of the Periodic Table. The periodic table, the basis of everything.
Okay.
Everything. So, yeah, there's nothing on planet Earth or in the universe that doesn't involve the periodic table.
Because I was going to ask, why are we having a year? Is this celebrating it, or is it, you know, raising awareness about the periodic table?
Both. Okay, so it'll be 150 years since a Russian guy by the name of Mendeleev came up with this idea of the periodic table, and he said, right, you've got these elements, these indivisible things that you can't break down into anything simpler. So elements like hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, blah, blah, blah. And he put them in some sort of order, and then he found that, if you line them up like that, then what you find is that this element behaves like this one, and this one behaves like this one. And so he put them in an order, and his was the basis of the periodic table that we know and love today. And so now there's 118 elements that are known to humanity, and there may be more, we don't know. We're trying to make more at the moment. So it's 150 years since he did that, and it's 350 years since the first discovery, the first documented discovery of an actual element.
Wow, that's a while ago.
So back in the day, like if you go into the Bible, they talk about brimstone. Mm. Brimstone is, anybody?
Nope.
Sulfur. Okay. So brimstone, sulfur, so carbon, iron, copper, silver, gold, all of those things, they were known to ancients. So the ancients knew that. So we don't know when they were first discovered. But we do know that the first element that was discovered, that was actually isolated, was phosphorus.
Mm.
Okay. And this was a guy by the name of Henning Brandt in 1669, I guess it would have been. And he got it by distilling urine.
Wow.
Mm-mm. And if you know anything about phosphorus, you've possibly seen it, that you've got to keep it underwater because as soon as it comes out from water, it just spontaneously bursts into flame. It's amazing stuff.
What?
Yeah, that's why they put it in bombs. It's nasty stuff because it spreads over everywhere. Once it lands on the skin, you can't put it out with water or anything like that. You've got to cover it with sand. It's really, it's nasty. So napalm is a mixture of phosphorus and sort of diesel fuel and stuff like that. Very, very nasty stuff. But 150th anniversary of the periodic table. So next year,
2019.
There'll be periodic table T-shirts.
Are we going to sing the song? Should we sing the song every week or something?
That's a very good song. Tom Lehrer, a classic. Yeah. Yes, a classic.
One. Are you going to get the table tattooed on you somewhere to celebrate?
What a good idea. What a good idea. I never even thought of that.
You just put it on your forearm. You can reference it whenever you...
I might just stick with the song.
I mean, that would be cool. You can't get much cooler than the periodic table.
That is going to be a sting.
I dare someone to text in and name something cooler than the periodic table.
Somebody texted
in though and said that American drug dealers use the metric system. I want to know how they know that.
I have heard that actually.
I mean, that makes sense.
The water analogy was awesome, but then you instantly evaporated it.
Okay.
All right, tattoos. You're going to get one, Will?
I don't think I'll get a small atom or something. I don't know.
I'll do
something. We've got a year to plan. That's right.
That's true. But it's never enough. So you can't plan this too far in advance. So.
Thank you for coming in, Alan. We'll talk to you next week.
Cool. Thanks.
All right.
That was Dear Science.
I can't do the tiles until I've done the waterproofing. But first,
I have to sort the jib, which I can do as soon as
I've run the wiring.
And I've done the plumbing.
As soon as he gets back from the hardware store with the stuff he needs. Don't be the one who held the job up. Don't be that guy. Just order your hardware at snappy.co.nz and they'll deliver it in as little as 2 hours, while you get on with it. Snappy. Find it, get it, do it.
Sprawl is a dizzying array of possibilities. A swirling kaleidoscope of experiences. A bit of a mish to keep track of everything going on.
That's why, besides broadcasting live all weekend at Sprawl, 95BFM are also bringing the Sprawl timetable to life using Samsung products, so you never miss out on anything.
95BFM Sprawl Live Timetable. Thanks to Samsung. Be where you want to be.
All the way from Bean Blossom, Indiana, Reverend Patience's big damn band are coming for a super fun night of punk-fueled ragtime folk rural blues. If you want to win yourself tickets, just stay tuned to 95BFM all this week. It's that easy.
The table's right here, doing very well, and it's hard to tell.
95BFM Border Radio presents Reverend Patience's big damn band, February 23rd at the Tuning Fork. Tickets from Ticketmaster.
And we are back. With headlines like Bloodbath, New Zealand share market braces for blow, and $85 billion stripped from Aussie share market, it's no wonder that people began to panic after many of the world's markets entered what some might call a correction phase. This all started last week when the US markets took a nosedive after fears that interest rates would be increased by the Federal Reserve, signalling what might be the end of Trump. Euphoria amongst investors. But where does New Zealand's economy fit into this? Is this so-called correction actually a precursor to another global recession, or is it just another blip? Reuben McLaren had a chat to the political editor of Scoop, Gordon Campbell, to find out more.
Let's move on to the share market panic that we saw last week. Yeah. You don't think there's a cause for concern in New Zealand, do you?
I think it's just overblown. I mean, this has kind of come and gone as a pressing concern, but I was sort of surprised by the ambiguity of the response from the Reserve Bank governor, I mean, who seemed to be sort of saying, briefly, what happened in the States was that the market commentariat saw some strong employment figures in the States and said, oh my gosh, this is going to lead to labor and skills shortages, there's going to be wage demands, inflation's going to go up, so the Federal Reserve's going to have to raise interest rates. And that happens to be, that was overstated, and you know, it was a bit of a panic, and in fact some people put it down to the actions of those investment robots which kind of can trigger sell decisions within milliseconds. There was some talk about whether that was actually part of the reason for the panic and why it yo-yoed so much, but the point here was that none of those conditions apply in New Zealand. You know, we have sluggish wage growth, we have no sign of inflation. In fact, during the December quarter, the inflation results came in below expectations. And so there's no reason, apart from a tiny amount of maybe imported inflation further down the track, that might come if the US did raise its interest rates, and they seem to be backing off from that now. You can imagine that money would flow out of New Zealand, our dollar would go down, it would become more expensive to buy petrol at the pump, so we might get a bit of imported inflation from that avenue. It would be kind of crazy then to penalise struggling New Zealand companies by then raising interest rates here, because the source of the problem isn't domestic, but you'd be hitting the domestic firms by raising interest rates, let alone, you know, mortgage holders and things who are being penalised for a panic that's been generated in the US stock market on Wall Street. You know, so I was just thinking, in this situation, we really need some clarity from the Reserve Bank governor. But the acting governor, Grant Spencer, just said, well, it's probable the next movement will be up, but, hey, it could be down. So it could be up or it could be down. And that's what we're paying this guy gazillions of dollars to tell us, that we, you know, it just seemed kind of ludicrous. It was not the sort of expectation, you know, or the kind of statement that you would, in a confusing situation, that you expected a bit more clarity and a bit more security for local firms and mortgage holders about what is going to happen. As it turns out, it's probable that interest rates here will stay the same right through into 2019. But, you know, we'll just have to wait and see.
Well, do you reckon this is the start or the symptoms of the start of the next global recession? Recessions seem to just come out of anything and then you get the whole domino effect.
Yeah, I mean, It's weird because you have that whole refish kind of sheep mentality where the market seems to go stampeding off in a direction. But there do seem to be reverse forces which push it back again. And at the moment, even Paul Krugman in the New York Times was saying, look, none of this stuff, none of this inflationary stuff that the Republicans are either talking about or creating by their actions with the tax cuts is actually going to create a recession. I think the Democrats would probably think that was probably the best way of tanking what remains of Trump's support. You know, they probably welcome a recession heading into the midterm elections at the end of this year. But it seems like there's enough genuine strength in the US economy at the moment that these kind of what are basically peripheral panics don't seem to be affecting the onward chugging path of the US economy. You know, the share market isn't the economy, is what it's the same here and it's the same in the States. They're just two different beasts. And I just think we should pay less attention to the ups and downs of the share market micro fluctuations day in, day out. I mean, there's only 10% of New Zealanders, so we're told, that invest in the share market. And, you know, it has to be the most keenly reported minority sport in New Zealand. You know, the amount of time that RNZ and other places put into what's really of interest to 10% of the population. And if they're that worried, they should probably ring their share broker.
Save the rest of us.
Yeah, save the rest of us from, you know, we all know that litany of the Nikkei and the FTSE 100 and the DAX and the whatever. And it's just like, oh my God, you know, there they go again. It's up, it's down, it's sideways, you know, who cares?
We don't agree with violence. We do not agree with the government. We do.
The Wire.
That was Ruben McLaren speaking to the political editor of Scoop, Gordon Campbell.
Now it's time for Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party.
Tracy Martin talks to me about the Child Poverty Reduction Bill, the Housing Stocktake Report, Māori sovereignty, and how important a leader is to a political party. I started by asking how her week has been.
Pretty full on, meeting after meeting after meeting, and we got some fairly cool bills up this week. The Poverty Reduction Bill came through yesterday, so that's really nice to kick that off and get that going through the system.
So those were announced last week or a couple of weeks ago, but the bill is going through at the moment?
Yeah, that's right. So it came out of Cabinet last week. I think it was last week. And so an announcement is made about that, and then it becomes a public document so people can see it. But it then goes onto the order paper and comes into the House for first reading. So there's a little bit of a delay between Cabinet announcing, going on the order paper, and then starting to work its way through the process to become law.
So it can still be voted down?
It would take either New Zealand First or the Green Party to vote against it, to vote it down, because the opposition, and you know, including the ACT Party's single vote, they don't have enough numbers to vote it down. But as it went through, I'm not sure about the ACT Party. He may have voted against it, but the National Party actually supported the bill.
With the housing stocktake report announcements, What is the government's response to this?
Apart from the fact that it's probably worse than we thought, I think the response is what it's always been, which is that we need to get on and we need to do this. We need to make sure that we've got, that we are building houses that not just privately but publicly building houses so that we can make sure that our people are housed. I think from my perspective, which is if I talk about it from a senior's perspective, I just want to make sure that while we're doing that, we're taking into account the fact that we've got quite a lot of older citizens who are being forced out of their homes, either because rents have gone up. I think people seem to think that, you know, they all own their own homes and they're all living on the pig's back, whereas actually due to marriage breakup or other circumstances, and global financial crisis is one of them, many of them are, they don't have their own home now. They've got a mortgage like everybody else, or they're renting. And so when we build housing stock, we have to make sure that we build housing stock for our older citizens as well as for our young families, you know?
Given that one of the criticisms was that the government needs to be borrowing more money, they're saying that we need to be borrowing money in this climate, is the current government open to that?
That's probably a question that needs to go to Grant Robertson and Phil Twyford. You know, the government has signed up to some financial responsibility, you know, agreements with itself, I suppose. Now, everything is fluid. If we had a massive crisis of some sort, let's say we had another major earthquake, then you'd have to reassess that. But with regard to whether the government's going to shift on those rules because of the housing report, you'd have to direct that to them. At this stage, I've not been party to any conversation like that.
Can I just go back to Waitangi for a moment also?
Yep.
There's been conversation since that the government's, well, the government's efforts to move forward and to address certain disparities between Pākehā and Māori are that the solutions are to look at the material issues and solve issues like housing and actual and physical poverty. So what, in terms of this, do you think that there needs to be more of an effort looking at Māori sovereignty?
I don't connect the two things, no, because no, I don't. I don't connect the two things at all. I think there is a, if we go back to Waitangi, what was Waitangi? Waitangi was the manifestation in writing and agreement about a relationship that we would work respectfully together to be as a nation a better place, right? So if that's what we're actually working for, the conversation about splitting sovereignty doesn't seem to match for me. The other thing I concern myself about sometimes when we have this conversation about sovereignty is I have seen in the past, not with this government, but in the past, settlements where iwi have taken what they can get because they've waited so long. Generations have died while they've waited to actually settle on their agreements, on their Waitangi commitments. And they've taken what they can get, and often those things were run down or there was no money there to support the development of the lands or the facilities that they gained under those settlements. So I have a real problem with sometimes actually the Pākehā side of this relationship handing over issues, handing over topics, handing over property, and then washing their hands of the relationship. So for me, I don't see how that's connected, no.
Is that not the issue, though, in terms of this kind of, and you may not agree with it, but the approach where you're giving settlements or you're giving financial reparations, whatever it may be, where it's a material gift, rather than having a conversation about actual sovereignty or actual determination by these two parties in that relationship?
Again, I guess I'm just focusing on, it's not a conversation I have, and it's not a topic that I bring into my conversation. What I'm trying to do with the work that I do, and most of the work that I do, particularly as Minister for Children, is around recognising that our Māori and our Pacifica children are overly represented in the most poor and in the most sort of disenfranchised in this country. How can we work better with iwi to make a difference here? The sovereignty conversation gets, for me and my, what I'm trying to do, it gets in the way. Does that mean that I'm dictating to Māori in a colonial type of a way how they will do it? Well, I hope not. That's why we're having these conversations. We recognise that we need to empower, take responsibility still, but empower iwi to lift these children. But to have a sovereignty conversation, for me, it just gets in the way of the issue, quite frankly. It's at a whole nother level. These children need our help now. To have a sovereignty conversation and then to walk away, I'm not sure that that's the way to do it.
All right, what's on the agenda for the next few days?
Well, I've got sort of back-to-back meetings today. We've got legislation coming up. We're finishing the dairy bill, restructuring bill that we've been putting through in urgency because the National Party sort of left it lying there, and there's a cut-off date that we need to have in legislation. We've got conservation bill coming through today. There's general debate today, which is always interesting. Obviously, there's quite a lot of chatter about who will be the next leader of the National Party.
Yes, I was going to ask if you had any thoughts.
Oh, I have no idea. I mean, we're all sort of watching who's having coffee with who and who had dinner with who last night and so on. But look, at the end of the day, I have no idea. And I couldn't pick it. There's some very capable people in there, but at the end of the day, only the caucus, only their caucus knows whether, you know, how those people are behind the scenes to work with.
Hmm.
And that's why caucuses really end up, that's why it should be a caucus decision, in my view, to elect the leader and the deputy leader, because only they know how those people actually work behind the scenes.
How important is a leader to a party?
It's very important. It's very important. I mean, they are the face of your party. I think have a look at the Labour Party and tell me how important a leader is. Right? So tell me, if you think about from Helen Clark through to Jacinda Ardern, have a look at the leaders that they've had. Now, all of those people were very good, actually, strangely enough, they were very good men. But they didn't have what it took to command or to take the group with them or to capture the imagination of the public and the sort of loyalty, at least, of a large chunk of the public. So who your leader is really important.
That was Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party. The Wire.
This next piece is a two-part extended interview. I spoke with Mohi Allen from Ngā Tauira Māori and with David Williams, a law professor here at the University of Auckland. But we're only playing some of each interview today. The full clips will be podcasted. Following from the Wire Worry Week investigations into Te Tiriti or Waitangi last week, I wanted to look further into the university's role of upholding that treaty partnership, the relationship between two peoples, in a physical and realistic way. First, I spoke with Mohi Allen, one of the leaders of Ngā Tauira Māori, the Māori Students Association.
Tēnā tātou. My name is Mohi Allen. I'm the co-president for Ngā Tauira Māori this year. I hail from the Māori North, Ngāpuhi Nuitonu, the biggest tribe in New Zealand, and also the tribe that hasn't settled their settlements yet.
Mohi told me that since its inception, Ngā Tauira Māori has and continues to be a tūranga waiwai for rural and urban Māori to connect while providing services to both Māori and non-Māori students to encourage collective participation in kaupapa Māori to create an environment where Māori language and culture is the norm. So I asked him what Ngā Tauira Māori does on a day-to-day.
We deal with all events that pertain to Māori. We hold all of our first year pōhiri. We do Māori cultural days. We do Māori graduations. We kind of are the place where Māori students come to feel at home as such in the university space. I guess for this year especially, we are focusing on kaupapa Māori sort of things, bringing back things like Matariki Day, Māori Language Week. But yeah, we're really just a bunch of Māoris that love to learn and to be educated and not kind of go with the flow, more like, yeah, being Māori in the university space.
And how is it that you, what's your capacity in terms of, you know, leading your own association? Does the university have much say over what you guys do?
Yeah, well, the university has a lot of say, especially in terms of funding and whether our events are sort of appropriate for the university. We have to go through a lot of paperwork and a lot of kind of whakawhiti kōrero about whether our events are applicable to all students, even though we only kind of are supposed to facilitate Māori students. So it's quite hard there. But in saying that, there are certain things in the university that kind of help us in terms of tuakana programs, kind of set up to bridge the gap between Pākehā and Māori and kind of for the university to uphold that treaty partnership. However, yeah, I think it's quite difficult for us as Ngā Tauira Māori to be Māori in the university space, especially since we can't be Māori outside of our marae and our Māori learning space here in Ahuone. Yeah.
It's interesting that you say that you can't be Māori in the university space, right, which implies, and it's not surprising, right, it's built as a Western colonial institution, right? The university in itself as the norm or the dominant thing is a Pākehā space, right? Yep. It is that. And when you are trying to be Māori in that, it's not compatible. Is that what you're saying?
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, one, it's hard to study in such a Eurocentric place, a university space that that forever supports the Western worldview and kind of marginalizes and stereotypes Māori worldviews. So that in itself is quite difficult. But even to be recognized as Māori at the university is also something that is quite difficult. Yeah, it's a bit like, well, in terms of us as Ngā Tauira Māori, we're seen as kind of the higher a pōhiri group. So we're there for the first year pōhiri, we're there to make sure that all things, make sure that there's a cultural face to the University of Auckland. But outside of that, we're kind of pushed to the side. You can barely really see us. Yeah, and we're not really needed outside of that kind of cultural face. Yeah, cultural misappropriation probably.
Well, it's a certain role, right, that you're there simply to fill, but beyond that, for your own interest, there's nothing for you.
Yeah, definitely.
So do you think that, as it's stated on the university website, that they are committed to the principles in the treaty, do you think that the treaty, or do you think the university does uphold that commitment?
I guess the easiest way to explain it is to look at our emblem or our logo for the University of Auckland. Right at the top of the logo you have the title, the name of the University of Auckland, in big, bold letters, easy to read, even for a half-blind person like me. But then right underneath that name, about 12 fonts smaller, is Te Whare Wānanga o Tāmaki Makaurau. Now, if I don't have my glasses on, I can't see that. And so that kind of is